The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This episode is sponsored by Smarkets. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder and director of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie LeConte.
Our guest today is the journalist Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
For nearly 6 years, Chris worked at the Financial Times before becoming policy editor at Newsnight. While at Newsnight, he was instrumental in exposing the scandal at Kids Company that led to its demise in 2015. And he and his team won the RTS Award for Scoop of the Year for that. He is now a partner slash editor. Although it should be partner, not an editor of Slash. I mean, that would be a bit weird. Anyway, he's now partner slash editor at Tortoise Media. In the news this week, then, Chris, we're going to kick off, inevitably, with Brexit. Another week, another podcast, another plan, Plan B, this week, as a result of cross-party talks. Chris, what do you think's going to happen?
Agreed.
The sound of
just total resignation. I think the facts on the ground keep not changing about Brexit. Labour is determined to kick the can down the road for as long as it can. The government is still on this sort of set of tracks, which it hopes is going to lead towards there being enough pressure to get the withdrawal agreement through Parliament. And everything else is just embroidery and time-wasting and can-kicking. With a slightly awkward thing where it's in everyone's interest for things not to really move. Like the Labour stuff this week has basically been about showing willing and showing some ankle to supporters without actually having to do anything. The Liberal Democrats have said they won't support another no confidence motion until they, you know, there's a clearer plan. Which is actually quite clever. Taking the no confidence motion off the table as a sort of weapon does at least hopefully, you know, force from their perspective Labour into a constructive position on Brexit. But God, it's so awful. We've actually taken a decision at Tortoise to try to minimise it for the time being. So like, it has to be a good thing to be worth writing about Brexit on, because at the moment it is not moving.
Speaking of things that aren't moving, these cross-party talks. Marie, what do you think?
I'm not sure. I was just going to say quickly before that, I do, like, it is entirely anecdotal at this point, and it's very much like just a few people I've spoken to, but there has been a bit of noise, I think, on both sides, so like especially on the kind of Conservative benches. So both, I think, MPs who would support a people's vote, who are starting to be like, actually, this is a mess. And I think that was reported on BuzzFeed yesterday, like the people's vote stuff is a complete clusterfuck. So I think you're starting to see a few Tory MPs going, you know what, if worse comes to worse, I might just vote for the deal. And on the other side as well. So I'm not, you know, I'm absolutely not saying she could get the numbers, definitely those people starting to change their minds. But I think the fact they've started thinking about it is quite interesting. Cross-party talks, I have no thoughts on them. I just want to die.
I mean, it's striking that the ERG has a WhatsApp group that it uses to send its sort of messages out to journalists. And the noises this morning are sort of comments about how, oh, well, thank goodness we're starting to sort of see progress on the backstop. We're starting to see some, it feels like, Jacob Rees-Mogg is preparing a ladder, which he might need at some point. I mean, I don't know if he's there yet. I do think the obit of the withdrawal agreement shouldn't be written quite yet.
Well, 2/3 of those surveyed believe that Jeremy Corbyn was wrong to refuse to enter talks with Theresa May, including nearly half of those who voted Labour in 2017. And in contrast to that, actually, a majority, admittedly only 53% of British adults, were willing to give Theresa May the benefit of the doubt and believed she was serious in wanting cross-party talks. Even Labour voters were evenly divided over the issue. I just can't see much actually coming out of them.
Well, I can't work out what's the
But
win.
If she's not changing her red lines, I don't see how anything's going to happen. They can chat if they want. It's always nice to have a chat.
Are we headed for a possible delay and an extension of Article 50?
If I were a European leader at the moment, I would absolutely not give any signals about how easy a delay will be to get, because it's the only thing that's going to fall. The moment that the timetable takes its foot off our political class's neck, they will start wasting time again, and they will wait for the next deadline to come up, because that is how they work. Like they,
it is a bit like an
essay. It's an essay. It's like David Cameron is.
My entire journalistic career.
that is journalism. To be honest. It's that people criticise David Cameron for being like the essay crisis prime minister. He's not. He was like the prime minister of an essay crisis class. And they, unless they have a hard deadline, they're not going to make a decision. Labour's interest is in delaying for as long as they can because they want something to come up. They want something that's going to force their hand. You know, and until that happens, which could be the deadline itself, they're not going to do anything. I mean, they should bring it forward if they couldn't get us out of miserable purgatory.
Psych, it's tomorrow. But how about, and actually kind of like keeping, I think that's halfway house, that sort of works with what you said. How about so like delaying it a bit, but so like making it like the last possible date. So, you know, like the bit where I think has been talked about. So moving it to the day before the new MEPs actually come into power, because that's the last possible date. And that means that we've missed the election. And actually, if anything, that makes it an even harder deadline because it's like, look, you didn't participate in the European elections like thereabouts. So this is your last possible moment. So that might make it an even harder deadline in the sense that there's really nothing you can do after that.
I mean, maybe I would just wait until like March the 28th before we even have this conversation because it's just... Honestly, there are so many of these MPs who haven't thought about this properly, remotely, only now starting to do their homework. And the anything that can force their hands into actually concentrating for a sustained period, that's what we need.
Do you think Theresa May would get away with an extension?
I think there'd be a lot of noise and a lot of very angry people for like, you know, a few hours, but eventually...
That ERG WhatsApp group would be going crazy.
Yeah, they'd huff and puff, and I think eventually, depending on how long it is, but I think that if it's... under like 6 months or under, for example, like, I think it's still she'd survive that. They'd be huffing and puffing, but
I think that's right. I think it also it works for everyone, right? So if you have an extension to the Article 50 period, and there's an off ramp that's clearly delineated, and there isn't no deal, a lot of these sort of people are doing their macho. Oh, why don't we just leave? I don't understand why we're even negotiating with them. We'll get to continue pretending that that's what they really believe, when in truth we know that that's not really what they believe because they're not as nuts as they pretend.
Moving on then, Chris, you worked for the BBC. So are you a loony left communist or a massive alt-right Nazi?
I'm usually both. I'm usually like you. Usually don't have to choose.
And repeat that joke for Remain or Leave. The reason I ask this is last week we had Fiona Bruce and Question Time coming under attack by the Labour Party for their treatment of Diane Abbott, specifically the issue of whether Labour were ahead in the polls or not, and whether that was described correctly, and also whether or not Fiona Bruce made comments at the expense of Diane Abbott. What do you think? It's the BBC at fault here?
So, I mean, I have to start off by saying, so I worked on Newsnight, and the BBC was very siloed. And sort of rightly, actually, it's a good thing, because sometimes, like, there have been events when, for example, Panorama has investigated a Newsnight story, or Newsnight has investigated a news gathering story. News gathering is what we call the main BBC news service.
Everyone's investigated Jimmy Savile.
So Newsnight screwed that up, obviously. That's actually how I got my job at Newsnight, because they had to fire a load of people. Then the...
Happy times.
Proper swings and roundabouts.
So I got asked to do stuff on Savile at the BBC, partly because they knew I had no skin in the game, right? I was a sort of clean skin on that topic. It didn't stop people accusing me, obviously, of having hidden stuff when I was not at the BBC, but let's put that to one side. Panorama actually investigated Newsnight over that. And there was this case with Nick, the guy who made allegations about a number of prominent people and child abuse.
Yes, a number of prominent people.
That was a Panorama going after a BBC news story. That was just the resolution of that. The big point here is, I don't know about the specifics of Question Time, which is also produced, I think, by an external production company. A lot of the stuff about the BBC is a misunderstanding of what the constraints on the BBC are. The first thing is, it doesn't have the right to decide what is acceptable speech or not. Like, we actually have to have a conversation about that. As a country, it has to be a political decision that the publicly funded broadcaster will decide, for example, that, you know, there are people who want UKIP to basically be barred from the airwaves. There are people who want...
People at the BBC?
No, not outside the BBC. But the idea that there should be someone in the BBC whose job is to be like, oh, no, like, we accept, this is the line, but this is unacceptable, is a really hard thing for a public institution to do of itself. Like, I don't think it has the political authority to do a lot of what people want it to do in terms of shaping the debate. What it's really bad at is it basically doesn't have enough respect for specialism, actually, is I think a way of putting it. It's not very good at saying our health editor thinks this is a really important thing, this should therefore lead the news, and this should be he thinks this is the way this works and this is what we should do. And he says these are the parameters of a reasonable debate that sane people can have, and that having a process by which that can feed into, say, Question Time, having a process by which the nerds at Milbank, who will know the truth about polling, can feed into the producers at Question Time. That linkage is really bad about getting specialist knowledge to the places where it's needed.
But, you know, I think that coming back actually to what happened on Question Time, and it's been quite frustrating watching a lot of people on the kind of like right centre and centre left to an extent, receiving like, oh, look at the Corbynites angry at the BBC again. Because I do actually think, you know, like the Corbynites did have a point. I think, you know, some polls show Labour being ahead, some polls show the Tories being ahead. I think Fiona Bruce, clearly, I mean, A, you know, it did kind of look like, I'm not saying she was taking sides, it did look like she was taking sides, but also these things don't happen in a vacuum. And Diane Abbott, we've seen before, is that she wasn't it, like there was this incredible stat last year, I think, about how half of all online abuse sent to either MPs in general, female MPs, was sent to Diane Abbott, you know, like during the length of that study. So, like, she is the politician who receives the most abuse in British politics. And so I think that, you know, again, yeah, like, it doesn't happen. You know, it's not any politician. I think it is entirely fair for supporters of Diane Abbott and of the Labour Party to just say, actually, no, that was not on.
There's a broader thing about the BBC and polling as well. I'm not sure, shouldn't you be better at persuading the public, which was the implicit question, is a good question in terms of, like, let's have an argument about what they're saying. I sort of think getting into, like, the realms of are you a politically effective operation is, like, is sort of the derivative of what is interesting and what the public broadcaster should be doing. So I think, in any case, she obviously got it wrong. Like, she obviously was incorrect in what she said.
And the BBC have come out and confirmed that.
Yeah, they didn't really apologise. I'd have preferred to have seen them say, Fiona messed this up, right? Mm. And I'm happy for them to say Fiona messed up because she's paid a lot of money to not make mistakes like that.
Mm. You can even say, you know what, she's quite new to the job. Like, we've all screwed up when we're quite new in jobs. Not quite as high profile. So, but
I mean, the early versions of this podcast were dreadful.
This isn't an early version, is it?
No, this is the first of the new ones.
The other thing is, one of the things about the BBC is there is like a massive self-selection problem with when people see things go wrong. So they remember the slights against their side. They don't remember the slights against the other side. So I sat next to the graphics desk on Newsnight, right? Which was the source of a lot of sort of contention. So
hats.
The hat, Jeremy Corbyn's hat, and putting a red tint on Jeremy Corbyn. And no one complained, though, about, like, really taking the piss out of Michael Gove by making him into Noah in a on a ship. People miss the things that they're not interested in, or the things which they quite like. And they only see the ones they like. The other thing is that the idea that our graphics team were sitting there plotting things, or that there's some, like, grand conspiracy, really overlooks the fact that the central condition of the BBC is massive, like, resource constraint. They have to do stuff in 10 minutes. They got an old background from, in the Jeremy Corbyn case, they got an old background from a piece about Gavin Williamson, just put Jeremy Corbyn on it, and didn't think very much about it. Oh, we'll put a tint on it, like, to make it a bit different. And that was it. No one remembered the Gavin Williamson version of that picture either.
Speaking of polls and Labour being ahead, or perhaps Conservatives being ahead, or in fact them being neck and neck, a new general election. There's been some whispers about that. Now, the general public's divided 44% to 40% in favour of holding a new election. So,
oh my God, yet again, the public cannot be trusted.
But, of course, this is heavily correlated with voting intention. More than three quarters of Conservatives oppose, more than three quarters of Labour support. Who'd have thought? And then Lib Dems broadly divide, but just in favour of another election. Can you see it? Can you see it happening?
Yeah, and I think that it's completely conceivable that we end up in a situation where, for example, the withdrawal agreement looks at risk of passing, and so the DUP take preemptive action to stop the withdrawal agreement, or the withdrawal agreement does pass and they pull the plug, or where we're heading towards no deal and some Tory MPs pull the plug. Like, it doesn't have to be desired by anyone for it to be the outcome.
Sorry. No, I'm just not going to make that joke.
Oh.
I'm going to, nope.
Right, disappointing.
Fine, much like the end of a student house party. And yeah,
okay.
Done now.
If there were a general election relatively soon, what do you think the outcome would be?
Well, obviously the funniest outcome would be exactly the same.
which is actually what a plurality of people think will happen. 31% think Conservatives would be the largest party in a hung parliament.
I love the idea of people supporting a general election, but also thinking it is going to be the same. So just people who just really enjoy elections. It's like, you know what? Just fine, let's just have another one.
Yeah,
why
more
not?
Than,
let's
more,
go nuts.
More than half think it will be a hung parliament. And so there's really not much belief that we would be heading for a majority of either flavour.
There is an interesting thing about Britain, which is that people in Britain genuinely think, because we've not had a catastrophe like for a while, like we've not had a Greek crisis, and we've not been invaded in like in living memory, that kind of thing, right?
So that's we're what like, you think?
We're a bit
it's
like,
very it's very left wing BBC view. That is,
there is like an element of like middle aged man who's got a motorbike about the country. Like we've not had an accident so far, so we're not going to have an accident now. And there's this sort of sense that, like, people sometimes say, like, so do you think we'll have a general election? You go, oh, maybe. And they say, well, how will that resolve things? Like, why does it have to resolve things? Can't we have unending crisis like other countries have had? Like, why does this have to go well? There is, like, a teleology to how Britons think about themselves and how, like, there's going to be a thing that will sort this out and then maybe an election or something. Like, no. We can just have terrible, broken politics for a really long time. Like, the new party may not emerge, the realignment may not happen. We may just have terrible politics for a really long time.
Or war with Spain.
I mean, ideally, war with Spain. That's like, that's looking like a good outcome at the moment.
And on a more positive note, then.
More positive than war with Spain.
More positive than war with Spain. I want to discuss the phenomenon of the hot Thatcher.
Oh, that was so great. That was so funny.
Now, just to explain, Gillian Anderson of the X-Files and various other things has been announced as the person to play Margaret Thatcher in the fourth series of The Crown. This has been described by the journalist Gavia Baker-Whitelaw as the Crown's most fiendish conservative propaganda move yet.
That is such a great combination of name and opinion.
Marie, what do you think about Hot Thatcher?
Oh, man. I mean, I'm not going to watch The Crown, so I feel like I don't have that strong an opinion on it.
Are you not going to watch The Crown? Chris, do you watch The Crown?
I've never watched The Crown.
Well, I decided that I was never going to watch The Crown, and then I watched it, and it was quite good.
I don't know. I mostly just find it really funny, partly because, A, The Guardian basically published a piece saying, it's okay, you can fancy Gillian Anderson as Thatcher. And it's like, oh, thanks. It is nice that, you know, it's taken the view, but, like, you know, you can now do this. But no, it's just going to be really funny to watch my friends have a boner for Thatcher. That's it. That's my take.
You have a different relationship with your friends than I do with mine.
And I think it'll make an interesting strapline for the fourth season.
Regrets. I've had a few. But then again, too few to mention.
We're joined now by Subject for our regular chat from Smarkets. Hello, Subject.
Hi there. How are you doing?
We are all doing. We're all doing well. Now, one of the things that we've been discussing today is the possibility of another general election. Is 2019 still looking the most popular option in your markets?
Yes, it is. It's trading at the moment at 41%. So that is the most likely outcome in the market at the moment. But it is only a little ahead of 2022, which is currently trading at 32%.
Oh, so it's either soon or a long time.
Exactly. It's either soon or a long time. We can definitely say that.
It's not just, of course, the date of the general election that could be massively important, but this everlasting question about Brexit and whether we will actually be leaving. Do you have any markets on when Brexit will be taking place, whether there'll be an extension to Article 15, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, we have many Brexit markets, as you know. The big one here would be the UK to leave the EU on March 29th, 2019. Which is currently favouring no at 81%. So it's pretty clear from our market saying that that's not going to happen on that date.
So the suspicion is there will be an extension?
Yeah, well, I mean, anything other than that. So it could be later, could be not at all. We've also got a market on what will happen first, whether it be extension of this negotiating period, a revocation of Article 50, or a hard exit. And in that market, we have 81% for an extension. So it looks like our markets favour an extension above everything else.
And indeed, that may be what eventually happens. We'll wait and see. One of the things we've discussed is the political impact that extension might have. If it did come to it and there was a leadership contest, inevitably the question would be, who's the next Tory leader? Now, there's been changes in that, I understand, in your market recently.
Yeah, there's been another shift, and we've got Michael Gove on top at 16%. Overtaking Boris Johnson, who's trading at 14%. You know, this market is so close and the percentages of implied probability are so low that these things kind of move on a whisper. And we're just seeing, you know, people trading in and out of positions all the time on this. So it's a very exciting market.
And so has that been at the expense of Boris Johnson? Has he dropped back?
So, yeah, as I said, Boris Johnson at 14% now, second place in that market.
But it's been a very fluid market. And so presumably over the next few weeks, we could see more changes yet again.
Yeah, I see that market changing every single day. So it's an incredible market to watch.
Despite the fact that she survived the no confidence motion, there are still question marks over Theresa May's leadership. Do you have a market on when she might be around until?
Yeah, so we've got a market on when she will officially cease to be leader of the Conservative Party. And it's trading, the most favoured option is 2019 at 65% implied probability. The market is really strongly indicating that she's going to go this year. We have another market on her leaving by quarter. And that's interesting. That's much more split. And we've got that to be 26% on April to June of this year. So that's the date when people expect it to go. So just after the official Brexit date.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that as we get close to the date. And looking further afield, the US presidential election, over the last month or so, we've seen a number of Democrats start to declare their hand and express an interest in seeking the nomination. What do your markets show on that?
So we have a market on the next US presidential election winner. And Trump is still leading the market at 30%, but we have Kamala Harris now trading at 14% with a recent announcement. So she's shot up into contention for this market. Still not very strong, still not the favourite, but, you know, she's in there and she's making a movement forward.
But presumably there's only one Republican and there's a whole host of Democrats.
I mean, I think that's clear that, you know, Trump is very likely to hold on to the Republican nomination for the next presidential market.
But I guess you never know.
That's why we have prediction markets.
And one of the people who has not yet declared is Beto O'Rourke. Do you have information on him?
Beto O'Rourke is currently trading at 12%. So he's just behind Kamala Harris in that regard. So it's Donald Trump, number one, Kamala Harris, and then Beto O'Rourke in that market.
Oh, interesting. And we know that that traditionally when candidates have declared, they have seen a bump in both the polls and the markets. So Beto presumably could expect something similar were he to declare.
Exactly. I mean, he's already traded quite well. And I think the last movement on his price was around December, early December. That's when he did a quick spike above Kamala Harris's chances of becoming the next president. And he's been rising again recently. Just at the 17th of January, we saw a big spike for him again. So, yeah, you know, there are lots of things happening in the US market and people clearly putting their views out onto markets and the market we have here.
OK, great. That's all for this week. Thank you, Sarbjit, and thank you to Smarket.
Thank you. Slow down and dance with me. Yeah. Slow. Skip a beat and move in my body.
Yeah. Slow. So let's move on to discuss Tortoise. Now,
yes.
Tortoise is your new organisation, Chris. The strapline is slow down, wise up. It's described as a slow news website. The majority owners are the co-founders James Harding, formerly of The Times and the BBC, and Katie Vanek-Smith, the former president of Dow Jones, and the Barzan family. Formerly, Matthew Barzan was the ambassador to Britain for the US. Tell us all about it.
The principle of it is it's a membership organisation, so
like the Masons,
more like the Guardian, I think. but actually, much
not much overlap between those.
So the idea is you don't just subscribe. There's a run of events that happen. So we're three or four a week. So this week we've had an event, an open news conference, where basically we had about 30 members come in to our newsroom and we sit around and we talk about what's in the news, and we prepare a little briefing notes for them, so they're sort of up to speed on what we're going to talk about. They've been oddly useful. I was sort of slightly sceptical, but I was happy to meet our members. We've had a load of commissioning that's come out of those meetings because people are like, hang on a minute. So we had a piece last week that was on what the question in the referendum, if there were a second referendum, should be. And it came from basically a group of our members saying, hold on, before we discuss this, what would the question be? And then, you know, that provoked a sort of useful commissioning thing. There are a few pieces that have come out of that stuff. We've also had we've got a thing tonight on modern dating. We've had a thing on NDAs. So they're sort of...
Can you talk about that?
But the part of it is, part of them are sort of open to our members, all of them, so that we can sort of hear what they think and we reflect back what they think to them through leaders and what we think. And, you know, we're preparing, because we're sort of having a dialogue with them. They don't quite dictate the editorial line, but they do influence it. So there are things where we may end up disagreeing with them quite a lot, but they've already influenced commissioning a lot.
So basically, if you subscribe, it's like you have a group of pet nerds where you can be like, this thing, it sounds interesting. Can you please write about
it?
You're like, oh, yes.
Yeah. Or, I mean, we've not yet had the experience, but I'm sure there's going to be stuff where we say no. Mm. And some of the people to come in and say, for example, why won't you write about how Russia definitely bought the 2016 referendum? And we, you know, have to be like, actually, we're not going to just say things we think are untrue, right? We are still doing this. The other thing about it is there's an app which delivers 5 items a day to subscribers, and they vary. Some will be video, some will be audio, some will be long read, some will be short. But the idea is not to be sort of, if you like, daily news. It's supposed to be sort of context to your life rather than what Jeremy Corbyn has said today. We don't have to make, you know, do takes on the day's news. And the hope is it's something that supplements and complements what people are getting the daily, in the round, from their other things.
This comes, of course, in the year when Tim Montgomery's Unheard launched, and there have been various other similar initiatives to sort of address the issue of long form reporting. How does Tortoise hope to differentiate itself in this marketplace?
A lot of it is about getting a critical mass of people who've got experience in this. You mentioned James Harding, who was the director of news at the BBC and formerly the editor of The Times. We have Mary P. Mills, who ran The Guardian's Saturday magazine. We've got Kerry Thomas, who was the editor of Panorama and Radio 4. Keith Blackmore, who's, I think, the father of basically Times 2, the Times' sort of feature supplement. There's a lot of experience in the commissioning and running this stuff, whereas a lot of these other things have tried to be people who've come from sort of outside journalism or have more limited experience of what's going on. We've also got a funding model that we hope gives us time to get going and build our critical mass. We started with a Kickstarter at the end of last year, where we got a few thousand initial members. There's another Kickstarter opening soon for another round of founder members. And then after that, it'll be about £20 a month for people over 30 and cheaper for people under 30.
It's reported that you have enough funding for 3 years. Will then future funding come from that membership?
The intention is to be self-sufficient. Yeah, we're not intending to be a charity. Yeah, and the
not even a charity like Kids Company?
I mean, definitely not a charity like Kids Company. The broader idea is also that we hope that we can do better journalism by not feeling like everything has to be hooked to today. There are loads of really great journalists who can take today's tiny, minute thing and explain to you why it matters in the rounds. But then it becomes like a parlor game where every small thing has to have a broader significance, when actually 99% of news doesn't have broader significance.
Is a new website for news a bit like a new political party?
In that it's going to be enormously successful.
in that you think it's going to be enormously successful.
In that the shadow of David Miliband is just like lurking.
But you have David Miliband. In that you expect it to be hugely successful. It feels like the right time, but for whatever reason, people are very. It turns out are very tribal about these things.
So I mean, we'll find out, right? So Katie Vanek Smith, the founder, is a marketing ace from News International. It's going to be a challenge, right? And it's a new business and we have to make it work. But, you know, we'll find out. I mean, we've had a really good response so far, and our members are in beta at the moment. So we are trialing stuff. We are publishing stuff to our current members already. But we are definitely still getting up to speed. Our turnaround time is still much too fast. We want it to be publishing things that we've commissioned a few weeks before, and at the moment our timeframes are too compressed. But there's a sort of you ultimately have to start somewhere. So we're starting now. We've got to work out what mix people want. We are trying to do less Brexit than is sort of feels natural, partly because we think that there's so much of it that's not probably where our competitive advantage is, and because we think people are probably quite bored of it. So we're doing it as and when it's important and when we've got stuff to say, but we're not doing it when we don't have stuff to say, which is the gift of only doing 5 items a day.
And so where do you think you fit in the kind of British media ecosystem? Like, whose lawns are you parking your tanks on?
So I guess there are people who buy newspapers for features, right? And we are in their domain. There is not a good British competitor to stuff like The New Yorker, right? So we're going to be doing lots of long-formy stuff. If you think of the New Yorker sort of mix and model as being arts and culture, features, politics coverage, but also heavy breaking stories. So, you know, Ronan Farrow published a chunk of his stuff there. That is a place we would like to be. Combined, though, with this unusual membership model, which is a genuine membership thing. We've got a few members who are super enthused and are writing us really thoughtful, really good, like, critiques every day of what we've done. And we're hoping that engagement continues and, like, that they continue to tell us, we want more of this, I want less of this. We did a piece on the first day on opioids and opioid abuse in the Northeast. And we had a guy from, a guy called Paul, one of our members from the Northeast. And he said, oh, I'm actually from Teesside. And we're like, oh no, he's going to be upset. And he was like, this is the most positive piece about this sort of topic about Teesside I could have imagined. And it was sort of refreshing that it was like properly analytical and it wasn't like, oh, it's grim up north. It was, no, here are specific things that are our issues. This is all fixable. And it was, you know, we've got really thoughtful members. We're really pleased.
Moving on, you have repeatedly called for the restoration of the Stuarts to the British to the British monarchy.
I think
is this something that Tortoise will be dealing with?
I don't think Tortoise. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to bring this particular plan to fruition. The long and short of it is, I think that if you exclude all of these sane options, which, you know, MPs doing their job, the executive being able to function, maybe we just have to try something else. And maybe dynastic absolutism is something that we've just got to think of again. I mean, the Telegraph today reported that ministers have been talking about getting the Queen to start refusing assent to bills. So
that's, I thought that was really fun. It's like, oh, what other bit do you want to mess up?
Like, I mean, that's going far beyond just Stuart restoration. That's going like that's going full Charles I, average of the Civil War, right?
Wouldn't that mean that some Duke in Bavaria becomes our king?
To be clear, I probably want James II because it'll antagonise the most people. he's dead.
Really dead.
But he had a proper military career. He got deposed after 3 years for being a would-be tyrant. But, you know, maybe that's what Britain needs today. This is not a wholly thought-through plan, I have to tell you.
And I'm on board with it. But like, it's happening.
To be honest with you, you can have zombie governments or, you know, dead kings. I mean, it doesn't feel like it's an obviously stupid idea at the moment.
And speaking of obviously stupid ideas, if you had to go on a reality TV show, which one would you choose?
Can I have a list of options?
You can have all of the ones that are on British TV.
You're going to have to bear in mind the fact that...
So things like obviously, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, Big Brother, Strictly Come Dancing. So the competitive shows, which would you choose?
I would have to have probably seen one of them to make a choice about this. But working in television for 5 years meant I basically watched no other television that I wasn't in.
Well, you could be in this.
I mean, I didn't work in television in same, so yeah.
Well, the dancing one seems harmless enough. I'd be terrible.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily a barrier to being honest. If anything is...
I know my family would be most enthused by being on the dancing one.
Strictly Come Dancing would be your favourite, and that is of course the nation's favourite as well.
Oh, really?
A quarter of people would choose that. Marie, what would you go for?
Well, I think that this is we're going to be a very annoying panel to ask this question to, because I've also never watched any of those shows, and I also would probably pick the dancing one. So
I think we're going to have to stop referring to it as the dancing one.
But my mum used to be a dance teacher, so I feel like the stakes would be quite high. But yeah, I think that's kind of my secret. I think I'm quite a decent dancer, so I'd do that.
That you could be the hidden weapon, and it turns out is actually very, very good.
Yeah.
I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which I guess is the animal eating one.
Second on the public's charts,
followed by Big Brother, then Dancing on Ice and The Jump. Dancing on Ice and The Jump.
Oh, The Jump. That's the ski jumping.
The ski one. Yeah.
Well, it's a decent holiday, and as long as you didn't kill yourself.
Well, that's, I mean...
But isn't it the show that had problems because people kept breaking bones?
Many people injured on it. So that's why they can't do it anymore. That would be the one I would go for.
I would stick with maybe the dancing then, rather than the dying.
Oh no, I'd definitely go for the imminent risk of death.
Dancing on Ice.
Dancing on Ice combines all the problems of a dancing show with the risk of jump.
Yeah, that's right. Lots of people do hurt themselves. I don't think in the same way. Thank you very much. That's it for this week. Chris, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
And thank you to Smarkits and Sarbjit. We'll see you next week. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled P-O-D-O-T-P-O-D-S.com.